You're tuned to 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces. I'm Leora Zeitlin. It's my great pleasure to have in our studios Caroline Golding. She's the soloist this weekend with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra in a pair of concerts and an open rehearsal tonight at the Atkinson Recital Hall. Lonnie Klein, artistic director of the symphony, is also with us. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Caroline, let's get started with you. You have a brand new CD out. You just had a CD release in September, I think I read, in New York. First one since your, I believe it was a Grammy-nominated CD in 2009 when you were just 16 years old. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
We'll talk about this new CD more. And tell us, though, you're still quite young, but that's 7 years since you've had a CD. How do you think your playing has changed?
Well, that's a very good question. I hope it has changed, but at the same time, I'm not quite sure. I definitely know that this repertoire calls for different things.
Let's just mention that this is big works. Where's your first one?
This repertoire is our chamber music works for violin and piano. So there's more of an emphasis on that duo collaborative process between the pianist and the violinist. There also was that on the first album, but it was little encore pieces and bonbons
virtuosic works. On this new one, you've got music by George Enescu and Dvorak, and then the very beautiful and not that often played Violin Sonata in D minor of Robert Schumann.
Yes.
So I think that's the one that has the pizzicato.
Pizzicato in the slow movement.
Yes, correct. Yes, and it is so beautiful.
Yeah.
So how does that change as you get older in terms of approaching really bigger works, more mature works, in a sense?
Well, this particular CD was done actually a year ago in Berlin, and I think that although the first album did require a lot of technical virtuosity and also emotional tension and impact, I think this CD with this kind of music is, again, it's more about the vision that you have with someone else, the vision that you can create simultaneously listening and being very aware to what's going on around you with that other person.
With the pianist.
So, yes, with another being that's also putting their... And also, that's not to say that that wasn't the case on the first album, because the first album was with Chris O'Reilly, who's a phenomenal, phenomenal musician. And even if it wasn't, like, quote, chamber music, it was, because he's so good.
Did you not appear on From the Top?
That's right.
That's with Christopher O'Reilly.
Mm, he brings out better things in you. So.
Okay, but it is true, the first CD, which is on the Telarc label, features a lot of works that are virtuosic for the violin. So when you talk about having to develop a relationship with the pianist in these larger works, tell us a little bit about your pianist and what that means in terms of your approach to chamber music, how it's different when you're really collaborating with a pianist and their part and your part. It's a different kind of playing than the really virtuosic short works.
So Danai Dorkin is the pianist on this album. She is half Greek, half German. She's we play a lot together. She's one of the people that I'm very grateful and fortunate to have made this relationship with only like a year and a half ago, and we've started to play a lot, mostly in Europe, because she's based in Berlin. She plays a lot of solo as well. And what I find intriguing about playing with her is that, or anyone, I guess, is that you are taking into consideration someone else's interpretation, someone else's experience, and someone else's, form of expression. And then you're melding it with your own, and it's kind of course, with the basis being this piece of music by Schumann or by Enescu or by Dvorak, which they have their own, you know, directions that they give you along the way of how they would, the piece is, you know, in a form of expression. So in a way, you have to put all of this together, and it's sort of this beautiful, magical process, and you are able to create some kind of, hopefully, art, you know, from all of that. So you're able to take all of these different worlds, and they somehow correspond, and, you know. So she's a phenomenal musician, and I'm very thankful to know her and to be exploring these works with her together.
You started playing at the age of three. Mm-hmm. That's pretty young. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how you first started playing and what inspired you to become a violinist.
Well, I have two older brothers that I have to thank for playing saxophone and trumpet. So they kind of, I'm very thankful also to my parents. They were so dedicated to, like, my growth and very supportive, although not musicians. So I would say my family were my first inspirations.
And when did you know you wanted to be a violinist?
I think I just did it. Like, I loved it so much, and I just, like, kind of naturally hung on to it. Like, it was like a dream, and now it's sort of still a dream, and I'm still doing it. So it's sort of like I don't really attach too much to it. I just love doing it, and then, you know, I'm very thankful that that I've been able to do it for this long.
So you've studied with some wonderful violinists, Donald Weilerstein, Paul Cantor. Yes. There were a couple of others whose names I'm forgetting at this moment. Maybe you'll tell us. Tell us some piece of inspiration or something about from one of your teachers.
Yeah, well, Mr. Weilerstein has influenced me and inspired me in so many ways, more ways than just one, and in life as well. And I would say that I share that opinion with many, many of his students who consider him like a guru of music, you know, in a way, and life. So he has taught me a lot, and actually kind of subtly been a catapult for certain things that have had to come out of me in emotional ways and in musical ways and in spiritual ways. So, yeah, I would say he's pretty cool. And also, I have to say, all of the teachers that I've had, and I know I've been just focusing on him, he always tells you to play from your sit bones. Like, everybody knows that about him. But all of my teachers have been wonderful. And Mr. Cantor was phenomenal. I had him for the longest period. Well, he and my first teacher, Miss Julia, and both of them were just impeccable at what they do. So I'm really, like, they're great. So
some violinists return to their teachers periodically when they're yes. working on a new piece and just to get their input. Do you ever go back to any of your teachers?
Yeah, I still study with Mr. Weilerstein a little bit because I live in Boston. So I see him whenever he has an availability, whenever I have availability and I'm there. I love to go back and play for him. And also Christian Tetzlaff, if I ever see him, like, now it's like very, very seldom. But like I still, because he's so busy and I have to go find him, like, at a concert. That's how he teaches. Like, you go to his concert and he you know, gives you a lesson, which is wonderful. But he's awesome, and he's definitely influenced me in other ways as well. These are the most two recent. That's why I'm accentuating
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So this weekend you're performing the Beethoven Violin Concerto,
yes.
a massive and a core piece of the violin yeah. repertoire, with Lonnie Klein conducting. So let's bring you into this now, Lonnie, as
yeah.
well. Tell first, Caroline, when did you first study the Beethoven Violin Concerto?
I first started studying it, actually, I think it was with Mr. Weilerstein, or around that time when I was beginning to study with him, which was probably around the age of 17 or 18. So,
and have you performed it many times?
I would say, among all the other pieces that I've played, not so much, but I played it, it's in the middle range. So I do it, you know, like, not as much as, like, Mendelssohn Concerto or some Mozart concertos, but mid-range. And I'd love to play, it's the most beautiful concerto ever. I would love to play it as much.
All right, give us say a little more about what you just started to say. It's the most beautiful concerto.
Oh,
what are your thoughts
so
about it?
Well, the second movement is just, like, this grand hug. That's how I feel. It's like this grand hug from a very unconditionally loving soul. And the whole thing is pure and divine and pastoral, but also at the same time extremely potent and visceral and full of this vigor that Beethoven has. You know what I mean? So it has all of these elements in it. And I'm not sure if the Pastoral Symphony was around this time. Was that later?
Number six. Yeah,
yeah.
It was a little bit later.
That was a little bit later. But anyway.
Has a little bit of that quality.
A little bit.
All right. So earlier you were talking about the relationship you have to have with a pianist
in
doing
peasant-like quality.
Peasant-like quality.
Yeah,
okay. Well, Beethoven can definitely
absolutely.
Do that. So you were talking about the relationship you have to have with a pianist in developing an approach to chamber music that's an ensemble, but even more so with an orchestra and a conductor. So let's bring Lonnie Klein into
yes.
this now, the conductor of the Las Cruces Symphony. Talk about, you've conducted the Beethoven Violin Concerto
yes.
a number of times, and it must be different with each violinist to some degree. So let's get your thoughts first, and then we can all have a conversation.
Well, I usually defer to the soloist. My teacher used to tell me this, you know, she was an orchestral musician, Elsa Ludwig Vedder, and she was always irritated when a conductor would tell her how to play probably one of the most famous excerpts, let's say Scheherazade or Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, because we study these excerpts, we practice them as an instrumentalist, and then suddenly the conductor maybe jumps in and wants you to do it a certain way, which is fine. But my attitude is that the violinist, is, in this case, Carolyn, has studied this for years and years, and of course I've studied it, but she's played it, and she has her own ideas, and it's really my job to sort of defer to what the artist does. Now, having said that, sometimes I've had issues with soloists that, you know, it's easier for one musician to bend than I can bend 74 musicians.
Right, right.
So there's this, we still have to be collaborative. We have to have the same ideas. But it doesn't take long, really, to sort of mesh. Our only issue is always you kind of want more rehearsal time.
Yeah.
You know, with an orchestra, professional symphony, we're on the clock, and it's a long concerto. It's 40 minutes,
yeah.
especially the first movement. So, you know, we've got to come to a consensus pretty quickly.
Right.
And of course, the orchestra's hearing it, and they probably don't know it at all in a lot of ways. They might have played it, but not everyone has. And so it's fun, but a little stressful at times.
Yes.
Well, that's the case.
So it's in this case, and it's no secret, Carolyn was supposed to come in last night. She missed her flight. So we're under the gun. We only have one rehearsal.
Tonight. And it's an open rehearsal, so you already have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that definitely makes things a little more stressful.
They'll see the process. That's good for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what about you, Caroline? Well, you haven't yet had a chance to play with the orchestra, but when mm-hmm. you've played it, even when you're playing something that you've played more times, Mendelssohn or some of the other core works of the repertoire, does it change each time for you?
Absolutely. It's another thing about chemistry, you know. You're putting all these visions together.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. So, Caroline, I noticed you have a very busy schedule. You just came from Seattle. I think you're going to Idaho. Then you've got concerts in the very near future in Switzerland, Austria, I think I saw, Sweden, Denmark. You're on the road a lot.
Yeah.
How do you balance the demands of being a performing artist with that kind of a schedule with whatever else you love to do in your life?
Well, it's a process. So I'm still learning how to deal with it. But I'm very thankful for people that have helped me figure a way out. Routine is very important. Doing things that are consistently active and healthy, and also utilizing your mind in a way that is very good for you is important. So I like to meditate, and I also like to do yoga, and that's basically how I survive.
Yeah.
And on the road, actually, I can feel quite calm and peaceful. You can get into a rhythm of your own in that way. Airports can be relaxing, depending on your state of mind. So I think that the important part is to find a home within your own being, basically, when you're traveling so much. And even when you're not traveling so much. You know, like when I'm in Boston, sometimes I have more trouble in Boston finding a home in my own being than I do on the road. So isn't that funny?
Yeah.
But it's a process, I think. So.
One last question, and then I want to hear about the rest of the program from Lonnie Klein. Caroline, you have on your first CD, at the end of these wonderful, as we mentioned earlier, virtuosic, mostly 19th century, some 20th century showpieces, some Cape Breton fiddling.
Oh, yeah.
And do you like to play other kinds of music like that, where it's a really different style?
I love that. I haven't done so much of it recently because I've been busy, but I would love to do that again. Absolutely. Cape Breton Island is a wonderful, beautiful place.
Yes, it is. When you're sitting in the airport, I'm assuming because you're young, you've got some various devices, and maybe you listen to music besides what you're practicing and rehearsing. What kinds of music do you listen to?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, well, actually, I haven't really listened to a lot of music in airports lately.
All right, wherever you listen to
wherever I listen to music, I love jazz. I love Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, and I love basically all kinds of music, just a classical, of course, I listen to. And like old stuff like Ella Fitzgerald, and that's not really old, but compared to classical, but old, like Ella Fitzgerald and Etta James and, you know, Art Tatum and stuff like that is great. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I'm
They're classics also.
At. Yeah, right? They're classics, yeah.
In that sense. Well, great. Lonnie, tell us what else is on your very interesting program this weekend.
Well, we're going to start with the Beethoven.
Oh, that's the first half.
We want to clean your palate.
Uh-huh.
Then intermission, and then we're going to begin with the Prokofiev.
Romeo
and Juliet, the mm-hmm. second suite, and I have extracted one movement from the first suite. And interestingly enough, when I put this program together, I thought we should set up Shakespeare. Even though it's not chronological to the music, what we can make it sort of chronological. And I've got Dick Rundell that's going to narrate. So he's going to set up each movement. So you sort of have an idea of what's going to transpire in terms of the play. And it is programmatic. I mean, when you hear the Capulets and the Montagues dancing at the beginning, the Dance of the Knights, you can just see that and feel the nobility. And then what I thought I would do, I paired it with, since so we've got two families, the Capulets, of course, and the Montagues, and I paired it with a 20th century composer, Michael Dougherty, and we're going to do the Red Cape Tango. That's from the Symphony Metropolis, and that's the final battle between Superman and Doomsday. So you've got this composer that is trying to bring two families together, Romeo and Juliet. If they marry, these two families won't war with each other anymore in Verona. And then pairing it with Red Cape Tango, which is, as I say, the last battle of Superman and Doomsday, which they both succumb to their injuries. But Lois Lane comes to him at the end, and he says, "Did I do okay?" It's a very interesting writing, lots of special effects. You can hear the battle. It sets the DSCA sets it up, which is a very famous Day of Judgment, Day of Wrath. There's horn calls off stage, on stage, sort of to simulate Doomsday calling out Superman, and then they merge together. You can hear the battle scene in the music, especially with the low brass percussion and string glissandos, lots of special effects. Just like you can hear the Battle of Tybalt in Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. So I thought it would be a nice couplet.
Yeah.
It's a difficult program.
Very interesting. And you've played some works of Michael Dougherty before, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wonderful, interesting composer. And that Superman Symphony, the Metropolis Symphony, is very interesting.
It's
and
cool.
Great choice using Richard Rundell, a retired German professor here, but with decades of Shakespeare experience on the stage.
Yes.
So that should be very wonderful.
Very cool.
Well, thank you both for coming in, Caroline Golding and Lonnie Klein. The open rehearsal is tonight at 7:30. At the Atkinson Recital Hall. Performances then tomorrow night at 7:30, Sunday at 3 with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.